Well, happy Tuesday, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight is kind of another one of those bucket list moments for me. I had one last week when Jackie Machard was on. I'm having another one right now because those of you who know me know that when I used to own a TV, which I haven't for a long, long time, my favorite show was Burn Notice. And because I lived in Miami and I always would see it filmed all around, and I just thought it was generally a great show. Tonight, my guest Todd Goldberg wrote the books, I guess they're the novelizations of Burn Notice, and so for that alone, I wanted to have him on the show. However, he just has released a new book with Brad Meltzer called The House of Secrets. I expect this to hit the New York Times bestseller list probably, I don't know, tomorrow, today, if it's not already there. Getting rave reviews. Todd is a very prolific author. His book, Gangsterland, was a finalist for the Hammett Prize. He also is a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and a bunch of other stuff. Plus, he also has a podcast. You know he's near and dear to my heart already. Without further ado, I'm introducing Todd Goldberg. Hi, Todd. How are
you?
Hey,
Pam. I'm doing fantastic.
Welcome.
I'm here. I'm home in Palm Springs where it's 120 degrees and where roaches are flying in the air. So I'm eager to get on the road and get the hell out of here and start signing some copies of The House of Secrets beginning tomorrow.
Don't come to Miami or South Florida because it's 100 degrees here and storming and lightning and, you know, power failures and all. Cockroaches are flying all over the place. The ants are invading all the air-conditioned spaces. It won't be any fun. Unless, of course, you go to Books and Books in Miami.
I'm in
the West Coast.
Where aren't there flying cockroaches? Because that's where I'm going to retire to. But if it's just Texas, I'm not going to Texas.
No. You don't want to go to Texas or North Carolina, any place like that. You want to go someplace where there's a lot of snow, like Nome, Alaska or something. You'll never see a cockroach there.
I don't feel like Jews are thick on the ground in Nome, Alaska, but I'll take a look into it.
Huh? Here you go. Listen, it could be a book stop. You could check it out.
That's true. That's a good point. I could always do that.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations on this book, The House of Secrets, with Brad Meltzer. Brad's also a Miami guy, as you well know. How in the world did you two decide to get together and write this book?
Well, as all things, it came from up above. And by up above, I mean filtered through my brother Lee. So as many of you know who are listening, I come from a family of writers. My older brother Lee Goldberg is an author as well. And Lee has been writing books with Jan Ivanovich for many years and best-selling books with Jan Ivanovich, I should note. And in fact, his new book comes out next week, and so I'm predicting a fight on the New York Times bestseller list between Lee and myself that will end with him gutted and left to one side as I take over the mantle of number one author in the family.
There you go.
At any rate, Brad and my brother are friends, and Brad came to my brother and said, "Hey, you know, I love what you're doing with Janet, but I'm really looking for someone that can complement the things that I don't feel like I do really well and that I can help do things that person doesn't do really well. I want to have a true partnership with someone and write a book together, not just have one of these books that just has someone's name on them," which is essentially how my brother and Janet work as well. And
right.
So Brad was looking for somebody, and Lee said, "You should talk to my brother." And so then Brad and I got on the phone one day, and, you know, within about 5 minutes of talking to him, we have the same sense of humor. We have the same cultural references. I said in another interview recently, it's like we had lived in the same fraternity house in college, and he was upstairs and I was downstairs, and I was stealing his jokes. So we just have this really great friendship. And he said, "You know, do you want to give this a shot? Do you think we can do this?" And, you know, we were both scared to death. I mean, my crime fiction has always been more literary. His has obviously been very commercial. And to meld the two together to make a perfect Reese's peanut butter cup of crime fiction was going to be a lot of work on both of our parts. And I said, "You know what? Let's do it. Let's try this. It could blow up in our faces, or it could be something really cool." And thus far, knock on the Lucite desk here in my office.
Sure.
It's worked out really cool. It's been fantastic. And it's a real partnership. It's a real, you know, sharing of ideas, experiences. It's not just me and then, you know, he puts his name on it or something. It's the two of us writing a book together. And that was really, really creatively edifying, I have to say.
What are the dynamics when you write a book with someone else who writes a different style than you do? Now, first of all, this is...
Part of it is, yeah. So when Benedict Arnold was escaping the colonies in 1776, 1776.
Right.
The exact date is always a little nebulous for me. At any rate, after he had turned coat, as it were, he sent a letter to George Washington asking for three things, essentially. Asking that his wife not be killed because she didn't have anything to do with it. Asking that the people that worked under Benedict Arnold, the other people in the service, not be killed because they had nothing to do with it, that Benedict Arnold had acted alone. And then, strangely, in this letter, he asks for his luggage and his clothing to be sent to him. Which is, you know, if I turn coat on an entire nation, I still would like my shirts and my books also, but I'd figure out a way to do that beforehand.
Didn't work out, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, you know, I went to Banana Republic today just in case I defraud the American government and don't have any shirts. But strangely, it seems like George Washington sent him his stuff. And he then spent, you know, the next rest of his life searching for Benedict Arnold to kill him. And that he did this kindness is a really unusual footnote to history. And that was the genesis that Brad had all along, and that the two of us sort of broke out into this larger, wide-ranging conspiracy. And, you know, to work together, to go back to your original question about, you know, with different styles, you know, we both have the same sort of touchstone books in our background. You know, we're both huge Elmore Leonard fans, and I think that plays a big role. And we both are we're both really invested in the making bad guys round. That there's not just sort of the banality of evil. That there's depths to these people. And so having those same sorts of ideas helps. But I think the struggle between the two of us, the push and pull that hopefully makes the book good, is that in Brad's books, he always works from the sense that people are inherently good and that they will do the good thing. Whereas in my books, in my worldview, I always come from the point of view that people are inherently bad and they will try to screw you at any time. And that dramatic tension between the two of us, I think, is what makes the book work. Because where I'd want to go dark, he'd want to go light. Where I'd want to be funny, he'd want to be serious. And so we had to find that middle ground. We had to find the kind of story we could both tell. And I think he got into me. You know, I have his voice in my head and his logic all the time. And for better or worse, poor Brad now has this dark, sad, you know, man who primarily writes about assassins in his head, and it's probably affecting him on a day-to-day basis in a way that he probably is uncomfortable with.
So, in other words, I shouldn't have asked for the money before I'd let you come on the radio? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, you should not have done that. That's a mistake.
Yeah. people are inherently bad. They always want something. Did you get invited to the White House? Because, you know, he goes there all the time.
I have not yet been invited to the White House, though. I should say this is actually a good story. You know, Brad pals around with the presidents. You know, he's basically at all times waiting for the president, his call to, you know, get advice on matters of social, military, and foreign affairs. That's not true.
No.
But
he has a lot of contacts up there. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
but I have actually provided security for the president of the United States of America. Now, granted, I was a volunteer at a golf tournament that President Clinton is in charge of, but I was the front lines.
You were
between,
there. You're ready to block the bullet, right?
Well, interestingly, so it's this. I live, as I said, in Palm Springs, and the Clinton Foundation has this annual Health Matters Summit here in the desert, and there's this giant golf tournament that goes along with it. It's a great show, and for a great cause. And I have a very good friend who works for the Clinton Foundation, and so she asked me and one of my colleagues at the University of California if we would be, you know, people in suits that stand in front of a room where the president's going to be. And we said, of course, sure. You know, who wouldn't want to do that? But the Secret Service made it very clear that they are there to protect the president, which made me realize,
even from you,
oh,
even from
they're
you.
Not there to protect me. Yeah.
Right. Right. That's too funny. Great story, though. Great story. When you're writing a book with another author, first of all, is this the first time you've collaborated on a book?
Yeah, it's the first time I've collaborated. Yeah,
okay.
It's the first time. And when I did Burn Notice, you had said at the top that they were novelizations. That's not actually correct. They were original novels.
Okay.
So everything that happened in the books was all of my ideas. But I would, of course, talk to Matt Nix and say, hey, this
right.
is what I'm going to do. And Matt would say, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I can talk about the genius of Matt Nix shortly. But so that wasn't really a collaboration necessarily what Matt and I had, because
no.
he essentially gave me free rein to do whatever I wanted, provided I didn't, you know, cut off Michael Weston's head or something. But this is the first time where I really collaborated with someone on a creative piece. And it was particularly hard. You know, writers are, as you know, we're mole people. We live in dark rooms and we don't talk to people.
Right.
And we just
right.
sit there amped up on coffee, eating chocolate-covered almonds and typing in our underpants. And it's hard to do that with somebody else. It's hard to just do that with my wife in the
picture.
House. They always show those pictures of, you know, writers in their natural habitat, and it's, you know, they have a shirt unbuttoned down to the middle of their chest, they're drinking a steaming cup of coffee,
right.
and there's bright light coming in through the room. The fact of the matter is, if you want an accurate photo of an author, it's in basketball shorts, no shirt, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're toggling between their Facebook and a paragraph.
Oh, that's interesting. When you decided to go ahead and do this project together,
mm-hmm.
How is the process itself? Do one of you write the draft and then the next one fills in other places? How does it work essentially? The actual nuts and bolts of it all.
So the way it started is I went out to Florida and for about a week, and Brad and I sort of beat out the whole book, and then I came home and I wrote a first draft, and then I sent it to Brad and he wrote a second draft, and then he sent it to me and I tinkered and I sent it back to him and he tinkered. But he was also reading stuff in bits and blurbs as I went. So I'd send him, you know, 50 or 100 pages at a time and say, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And he'd say, hey, let's do this or let's do that. So, you know, he really gave me a lot of freedom to get my ideas out first. And then he, you know, he's a master at plotting, and I'm not. I admit that freely. I am, you know, I'm a character person. All of my books invariably are just about people and bad stuff happens to them. The machinery of a worldwide conspiracy is not something I think about unless I'm a target and they don't have something that I want, and then I think it's a conspiracy against me. And so, you know, I would put the machinery in place and I'd leave out big gaping holes and I'd say, you know, hey, talk about Benedict Arnold here. I have no idea anything about Benedict Arnold. And so it was really a dance back and forth. By the time we had turned in the final draft, you know, it had taken us about a year and a half, and I couldn't see what I had written and what he had written. I couldn't really remember.
How nice.
And, you know, the other thing is that my chapters typically in my books are pretty long because I come from a short story tradition. I wrote short stories to start with as a writer. So I tend to look at chapters as 15 to 20 pages because in my mind, the crazy mind of a writer, that's achievable. I know how to write a 15-page thing. But Brad's chapters are like 4 pages. And so I don't really write with those natural cliffhangers that he does. And so I'd send him a chapter of 30 pages, and he'd be like, man, this is like 8 cliffhangers in here, and it's 9 different chapters. We got to mess this thing up. And so there's a part in the book late in the book that for me was just one 20-page chapter and is now something like 8 3-page chapters spread out over 200 pages of the book.
Wow.
And I just marveled at it because I can't do that. I don't see books like that, but he really does. And I think that's his genius, is this propulsion of plot constantly predicated on you needing to turn the page. I mean, it's the essence of a page turner. And he does that better than anyone in the world. And it was a lesson to me as a writer to see how he does it. And then, you know, I'm writing my own standalone book right now, or actually a sequel right now to a previous book, and it's hard to get Brad Meltzer out of my head. And sometimes I talk to him quietly in my head, and that's also disturbing for people when they hear me talking to Brad Meltzer in my head.
Yeah, I'm sure he's saying, keep it shorter, make it shorter. You don't need to have a 50-page chapter, right?
So yeah, that's his mantra.
Did you storyboard before you got together? Even when you sat down in Florida, did you storyboard the basic premise of the book so that you kind of sort of knew where you were going, and then you kind of worked from there as like a blueprint almost?
Yeah, that's precisely what we did. We had these big flip charts that we wrote on, and so we had some key things. You know, I remember this key plot idea that we came to, and I won't spoil it because it's the sort of the big plot reveal of the book. We'd been working on it for 3 days or something, and then one of us said, "What if?" And it was like, "Oh, we got to go back and redo everything we've talked about." And I still have all of these, you know, flipboard pages that I, you know, stuffed in my bag and flew home with. But we really did a lot of character work together, like figuring out who these people were, and the general arc of the book. But it ended up changing, of course, because you're always better as a writer in the moment than you are planning it out. And giving yourself over to the organic process of creativity, I mean, that's what we do. You know, that's what we have to do as writers. Otherwise, we're just painting by the numbers.
Well, you plan your vacation and you're going to go up 95 from Miami to New York, but of course you're going to take side trips. So it makes sense to me. You know, you have a general direction on where you're going. The book is really, really well paced. It's very fast, and I like that, especially because a thriller should be fast paced. There are a lot of dead herrings in there. Red herrings, not dead herrings. Red. There might be dead herrings too. I don't know. I didn't.
Yeah, there might be dead herrings.
Yeah, there's some red herrings in there too. I like that. A lot of little things that weaved throughout the story. But I like what you were saying about character. I can't get invested in a story that's only about a plot. I have in my reading experience, and I read pretty extensively. As you heard me say earlier, I don't have a television anymore. Burn Notice 10. You know, there's no reason to keep it. No. That's not really what happened. I just got tired of it. It broke down and I never got a note. But so I read an awful lot, and I have to somehow, as a reader, I have to be invested in someone in that book, whether it's the protagonist or if I like the antagonist, I like their POV. I understand what their motivation is, whatever it is. So that works really, really well. Do you think you'd like to do it again, maybe with Brad or with another writer? You'd like to co-author again?
Oh, I don't think I'd do it with anyone but Brad. I had been offered things over the years that I had said no to, and the reason is a pretty simple one, which is that I want to write my own books too, most importantly.
Sure.
The opportunity to do it with Brad, you know, it's sort of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I mean, this is a person who knows how to do something I don't know how to do, and it's like being in graduate school again, learning from him. I can't imagine that I'd do it with anybody else. I'm pretty confident we'll do another book in this series, I hope. For me, I only have so many books I can write, and I like to spend a good amount of time on it. I think, you know, if you're putting out a book every 3 months or something, you're not putting a lot of care and concern into it. And I want to be able to take a year to write a book. And I think, you know, Brad is of the same mindset as it relates to Hazel, our main character in The House of Secrets. that,
right.
you know, we want this to be something that continues on. And, of course, the book is presented in a way that makes it clear that Hazel has some more things to do in her life. But I can't imagine doing it with anybody else. I can't imagine – I mean, I couldn't do House of Secrets with anyone else, but I can't imagine
sure.
co-writing another book with anyone else. And my wife is probably at home saying, could you just take like a week off? Could there just be a day when you're not at home
right.
literally killing people on your computer? Is there a day where you're not blowing up an American city on your computer where we could just go out? Could that happen?
How funny. Have you ever considered writing with your brother?
No. I love my brother.
Your styles are very, very – I've read almost all of his books, and I've read every single one that he's written with Janet Ivanovich. I like them very, very much. I like caper books anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They're tons of fun. I want to talk about your books, though, because
sure.
you have an interesting repertoire of books. Gangsterland, you wrote a couple years ago, and this is a little – well, I asked you earlier, and you said – it is a little bit of noir. It's crime fiction, Gangsterland, obviously it has to be. Tell me about this book, tell listeners about this book, and tell me what motivated you to write this story, because it's a very interesting one.
Gangsterland was sort of the book I've been trying to write for quite a long time. It's about the basic nugget of it is that it's about a Chicago hitman who kills four federal agents in Chicago and is essentially sold to another organized crime family in Las Vegas, where he has to hide out as a rabbi in a synagogue owned by Jews, obviously, because it's a synagogue, but run by the mafia in Las Vegas. And he hides out as a rabbi for so long that, in effect, he has to become a rabbi because that's his cover. And so it's a novel about this guy, this hitman in Las Vegas, pretending to be a rabbi, and he's being chased by an FBI agent in Chicago who has been defrocked. And it's noir as all get out, that's for sure. Funny, but it's also, you know, it's also an examination of fate in a way. Writing about a character who has to pretend to be a Jew, as a Jew, it's a reversal of fortune. That's for
it
sure.
It is.
But
taking it further to making him a rabbi is really interesting. I would imagine in the story there's quite a moral shift with this guy as well, but there are still repercussions, right?
Yeah, there's a huge number of moral shifts. I mean, it's essentially about a bad guy who is given the opportunity to have new neural pathways growing inside his mind and different ways of looking at the world. And so as he slowly becomes a rabbi who's still a hitman, he has to reckon with the faith, and he has to reckon with the things he's done and who he is and who he's going to be. But most importantly, he misses his wife and kid. The whole book is also predicated on him trying to figure out a way to get back to his wife and his child, both of whom think he's dead. So there's a battle for fate. There's a battle about the city of Las Vegas. You know, it's very much a novel about the point in time in Las Vegas, 1998 and 1999, when it stopped being for families. That was so the slogan for Las Vegas that
right.
everyone knows now is "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas." But before
sure.
it was "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas," it was "Las Vegas is for families," and
right.
which is absurd. And
right.
so he's at that moment in time in Las Vegas where it's becoming a booming suburb, where Oscar Goodman, the mob lawyer, is about to become mayor of the city, just when everyone is going to be becoming sopranoized and glorifying the mafia. And here he is stuck in this world. So it's comedy, it's black comedy, it's social satire, it's a little bit of everything. And it was a book that came out of a short story that I'd written for one of those Akashic noir books, the Las Vegas noir. So they used to do Boston noir, New York noir, San Francisco noir, etc.
Sure.
And they did one about Las Vegas, and I wrote it I wrote the short story about a part of Las Vegas where I lived briefly, which is Summerlin, which is a master planned community where all the homes are gated and all the lawns pristine, where, of course, horrible things happen on a daily basis. So it came from that short story. The genesis was a simple one, which is there was one day I was stopped at a stoplight here in Palm Springs, and I looked over, and there's this old Native American cemetery not far from the airport in Palm Springs, and there was a person walking out of it. And I just had this thought that, man, if you wanted to get away with murder, the thing to do would be to take a dead body and bury it in a cemetery. And then I was like, wait a minute. Hold on a second. There's money involved in this. Who runs a cemetery? It's a Jewish cemetery. So there's a rabbi. There's a rabbi who runs a Jewish cemetery. And Jews don't embalm, so bodies would be gone really quickly. And then, you know, over the course of a stoplight, this whole story all of a sudden exploded into my head. And the result's been great. You know, the book came out in the end of 2014 and was a big commercial success. And CBS bought the rights for a TV show. And I'm writing the sequel literally right now. Right when you called, I had to hit the save button. So it's been something that has been percolating in my mind since 2009, essentially. And it's been a really gratifying experience to be able to write this book and have people really respond to it.
I was looking at your bio and the other books that you've written, Other Resort Cities, Where You Live, Simplified, Living Dead Girl, Hungry Thirsty Las Vegas, Fake Liar Cheat. Every single reviewer who has commented on your books has always says that you have a witty sense of writing, that there is so much humor involved in your books. It's a really for great social satire and one fine comic rag is what the Bellingham Herald said. And the LA Times said a crazy good time. Entertaining, movie-thin comedy, not out to change your life, only to offer an amusing read, which it does with high success. Kirkus, that's on Fake Liar Cheat. So,
God, I haven't heard those reviews in years. That book came out almost 20 years ago now. My God, I forgot I got those reviews.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So you know, but you have kind of a twisted little sense of humor there, and and that's kind of nice. You like to share that in your pages, it seems.
I have a thing. I have a dark view of the world. I mean, I think everything's a little bit better if it's funny. But I also think that if you're writing crime fiction, things can be funny, but I think if you're handling dead bodies, you have to treat them with some kind of dignity. And that's something that's evolved for me over the years. It used to be as a writer that I didn't mind piling up bodies in a book and having someone say something witty about it. And now, my point of view has changed, and I want to make sure that, you can have a good time while reading these books, but if someone dies, that there's repercussions, that there's concentric circles that come from crime. That sounds a little weighty for someone who, writes comic novels, but I don't feel like you can kill people in books and have it mean nothing. And so I have always tried to balance the horror with a little bit of black comedy, just because, that's our lives, right? That anytime something horrible happens, invariably there's something weird that goes along with it.
Well, I understand what you're saying. It's kind of like, you don't want to – you never slap a rattlesnake. You just know something bad is going to come from it.
I don't even go places where there are snakes. God, there was one time my wife and I were hiking, and a snake went by our path, and that was it. We were done hiking forever. Like, we don't hike anymore.
That was it. I'm never hiking again. I would be the same way, honest to God.
Yeah,
I would be the same way. you've also written in anthologies. You've written a lot of you like short stories quite a bit, it seems. Will you write another short, do you think?
I don't know. It's probably been 4 years since the last short story I wrote. I've been writing a lot of essays in the last few years. I was in Best American Essays in 2013, which was one of the honors of my life, to be perfectly honest. It's something that I couldn't believe had happened. And I've found that...
Who edited?
You know,
who edited for you?
Cheryl Strayed was the editor of that year's Best American Essays.
She really rough, you know, rough to have such unknown people and talented. Wow.
Yeah, that was a tough one. but, you know, I love the short story. If I could just write one thing for the rest of my life, it would be short stories. But I have the champagne problem that people like my novels. And I just don't have as much time as I used to write short fiction. When I wrote Other Resort Cities, which came out in 2009, I was at that same time writing the Burn Notice series. I wrote five of those Burn Notice books. But
we're
going to
talk
in
about
between,
that. That's the cherry on top. So don't ruin
all right.
it for me, okay?
I won't ruin it. in between writing the Burn Notice books, I didn't have a lot of time, but I had all these other ideas I wanted to do, and so I wrote Other Resort Cities as a collection of stories, and they were published obviously individually in different magazines and places.
Right.
But I wrote the stories that are in that book with the intent of them being in the book, so they're sort of thematically connected. But of late, I just haven't had the time to write very many, but I'm working on some new essays, and that I find, you know, pretty fulfilling, and it fulfills the more literary side of my mind that I think I sometimes turn off when I'm writing crime fiction. You know, at heart, I'm a 23-year-old pretentious dude in a turtleneck at a coffee house who wants you to listen very hard to the emotional things he has to say. But
right,
I'm,
right.
in fact, a 45-year-old who also likes nice things, so therefore I have to only do that periodically. I can't constantly
right.
be that person.
You can only indulge occasionally.
Yeah, but I
well,
think, you know, as a full-time writer, you know, I feel like I have a lot of things that I want to write in a lot of different formats. And if there's one thing, actually, that my brother taught me long ago when I was just starting out and he had already established himself as a writer, it was that, you know, be really good at more than one thing. Know how to express yourself in more than one field, and you'll always have a way to do it. And it's, in fact, it's sort of the mantra that I've also put into the graduate school that I founded. So I founded the MFA program in creative writing and writing for the performing arts at UC Riverside, and that's our mantra, you know, that you're going to be a well-rounded writer. You're going to work in a lot of different formats. And I just feel like I'm a writer. That's what we do. We write. I'm always going to write different things.
I love it. So let's talk about my favorite stuff.
Okay.
You know, because this part's about me right now. As you know. Okay. All right. So Burn Notice. You wrote five
yes.
books. You talked to Matt Nix. For those of you uneducated and who've lived under a rock most of your life, Burn Notice was possibly the best television show ever to be filmed in Miami. One of the few totally filmed there.
mm-hmm.
But it was a ton of fun. It changed a lot over the however many seasons there were. I can't even, 8 or 9 seasons. I can't remember
right.
exactly how many there were. But anyway, Todd Goldberg wrote 5 books that were interlaced, the series. They were not novelizations. I thought they were, and they were not. Matt Nix is the producer of the show. Did you go to the set to get a feel for what was going on, or were you a fan of the show? How did this happen for you?
So, actually, Matt and I have known each other since we were in college. Well, and in fact, we had mutual friends before that. So I grew up here in Palm Springs, and Matt's father was the principal of a local private school. So we crossed paths most likely as teenagers, but then he moved away. But then mm-hmm. in college, he was my best friend's roommate at UCLA. So I knew Matt throughout college, and I'd always kept track of his career, and he kept track of mine. And when Burn Notice came out after the first season, I mean, I was watching it just like everybody else. I mean, it was
right.
awesome. It was a great show. It was like an
was
Elmore Leonard novel.
Like it, right.
No, it was like an
right.
Elmore Leonard novel on TV. It was my favorite show. Penguin wanted to turn Burn Notice into a book series. And my brother, so again, you know, like I said, everything ends up filtering at some point for my brother. My brother had very successfully been a writer on Monk and then had transitioned
right.
into creating 20 or something Monk novels that were extraordinarily successful. And so Penguin came to my brother and said, hey, do you know anyone that you think could do that same thing with Burn Notice? And he said, well, you should talk to my brother. He and Matt Nix are friends. And And so then Matt called me and was like, would you do this? Is this something you'd be interested in doing? And I was like, hell yeah, I do it. I love Burn Notice.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
So, you know, Matt and I had several conversations, and it was great. And Matt Nix is one of the best human beings on earth and one of the best people in Hollywood you'll ever, ever, ever meet. Just kind
wow.
and generous and a wonderful family man and just a good and decent salt of the earth human being. So, to sort of get the idea of how they structure stories, because it was a very strange story to see on TV because it broke all the rules. You knew who the good guy was.
It
you
did.
Knew who the bad guy was. All that had to be gleaned was how Michael Weston was going to screw them over. It wasn't
right.
cops and robbers. It was a straight caper. And to do that in a book is a little difficult because if you know who the good guys are, you know who the bad guys are, then, you know, what's there to do? So I spent, more than a couple days in the writer's room with Matt and the writers as they were breaking season two. And just sort of listening to their logic about how they created character and how they came about with stories, which was really helpful just to sort of understand the way they went about things. But the challenge for the first book was that for whatever reasons, you know, the negotiations took a while to get me on board. All these things happened very quickly, or not very quickly. It was a prolonged thing. And then all of a sudden it was November, and we finally signed the deal, and I believe Burn Notice's season got moved up. And
yeah.
they said, hey, we really need this book to be out in March. And I was like, it's November. And they said, yeah, we really need this book to be out in March. And I said, so when's it due? And they're like, well, if you could get it to us by January 15th. And I said, I can't write a 285-page novel in 60 days, you know, with Thanksgiving and maybe Christmas off, you know, 2 days.
Right.
And they said, all right, so if you could get it to us by February 1st, that would be great. And, you know, this was a long time ago at this point. This was 9 years ago. And so I was younger and had more energy. And so I was like, you know what? What the hell? I'm gonna give it a shot. I'm going to see if I can write, you know, essentially a 75,000-word novel in 2 months. I wrote an article about it in the LA Times right when the book came out. And, you know, Pam, the thing is, sometimes you just got to see if it's possible. And so I wrote.
It was possible.
It was possible. I wrote Burn Notice, The Fix in 60 days. It came out right on time. However, as you'll know when you go home, there's about 15 typos in the book because I don't think they copy edited the first edition. I think they just
probably
took
not.
It from
they
my
didn't
computer.
Have time. They had to give you those extra two weeks to
yeah.
get the book written. Don't forget.
It was an absolute sprint, And a lot of folks say, oh, gosh, The Fix is my favorite one. And I just think, I don't even know what's in that book. I have no functional memory of what happens. I think there's a mortgage fraud. I don't really remember.
I love those books so much that I was thinking, oh, maybe in 6 months there'll be another one. And then every 6 months I would just go ahead and get another book. So I would go
right.
to your Amazon page all the time saying, okay, well, first of all, I was heartbroken that I couldn't go into a bookstore and say, what do you mean you don't have the Burn Notice book? How is that possible? No, you don't understand. Todd Goldberg is writing these books. They're magnificent, you know. You'd think I was talking Pulitzer Prize or something. I think
right.
it could have been. But I'm looking on the Burn Notice website, and, you know, then the first book pops up. I order it right away, and then it's like forever until the next one. Honest to God, I had such a good time reading those books, and they really just fell right in line with the stories. And because at the time I had a television and I had cable, I could always replay the episodes. You know, you could see last Sunday's episode this Sunday,
right.
and catch you up and all. So I was never worried about missing anything. And then I had the books. I had the Goldberg books, you know, which were golden.
They
mining.
were They were super fun to write. You know, I wrote five of them, and I could have kept writing them for the rest of my life. You know, they offered me the opportunity just to keep doing it. But I wanted to write Gangsterland, and I wanted to do other things. But, you know, Michael Weston, he is in my head on a fairly regular basis. I mean, I wrote the words, "When you're a spy," about 8,000 times over the course of five books. And so I'm always looking at things. Like, I'm sitting in my office at the university right now, and I see a pen and a paperback book, and a student gave me a shaving kit as a gift. And I could make a bomb out of those things. It would take me about 5 seconds. I could do it. Michael Weston got me eating yogurt. I mean, he's a fantastic character, and I got a kick out of writing him. And eventually when I started writing, and I guess it was the second book, writing from the point of view of Sam and Fiona also, that was a lot of fun. I mean, Sam was always really my favorite character because he was a comic figure, and I loved to write him. But getting into the mind of Fiona was super cool. You know, she's tough and sexy.
Oh, kick-ass woman. I mean, there was nobody
violent.
Like her on
no.
Yeah. There was nobody on her like her on television. This was the first really strong woman who, you know, in this type of a genre, a caper show, that really could have carried the whole thing by herself if she had to.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was
I
really
agree.
Interesting.
And there hasn't
now,
been a woman
I've
like her on TV since. I mean, maybe Jessica Jones or something. But she, it's a Marvel character. It's a Netflix show.
Okay.
But she was, you know, she was so much fun, and the tension between Michael and Fiona was, you know, it was like Sam and Diane from Cheers, but with guns.
Right.
I always loved that.
You know, you didn't write to the end of the series, did you?
No, I stopped writing them in 2000. I think, if I remember correctly, the Bad Beat, the last one, came out in 2011, and the show ended up going till I think 2014, if memory serves me correct.
Right. Because the last couple of years were very dark, and that show turned kind of dark. They, you know, they blurred the lines between good and bad. That's just my opinion,
right.
Which has nothing to do with you at all. But I want to talk about something else we have in common, and that is you do a podcast called Literary Disco, where books come to dance. Let's talk podcast. Tell me about it, and how did it happen?
Well, Literary Disco, we're coming up on our 100th episode. It is, I co-host it with Julia Pistel, who is a radio personality in Connecticut and an essayist, and Ryder Strong, who a lot of people probably remember from his role on Boy Meets World. He was an actor. He still is an actor. He's an actor, a writer, and a director. And the three of us actually met in graduate school, and we'd been having this continuing conversation, and by conversation I mean loud argument, about books ever since. And we decided in, gosh, I guess it was 2013, that we should do a podcast. And it's extraordinarily popular, shockingly. We have a bunch of fans that follow our every whim. We do live shows periodically, and you know, 200 or 300 people show up for it. But it's you know, it's just a conversation with the three of us where we talk about books and literature, and we read a book and we break it apart into little pieces. Sometimes it's a contemporary novel. Sometimes we'll read a Sweet Valley High book. We'll read poetry. We'll read a play. We read just about anything. And then sometimes we have authors come on, or we will have a high school teacher come on and tell us what it's like to teach high school kids The Stranger. You know, we do a little bit of everything because we don't ever have a prescription for what we're going to do. We do things that just sound fun for us. And I guess that is a collaboration that has worked for me other than the one with Brad. You know, we have a great time, and the best thing for us is we get to champion books that a lot of people have never heard of. You know, we get to talk about things.
Absolutely.
Particularly to young folks. There's a lot of kids that listen to the show because of Ryder. And we get to talk to them about books that, you know, might be something that changes their lives. You know, we talked about this book, George, not long ago, which is about a kid in elementary school who essentially is becoming transsexual and dealing with his identity, which becomes her identity. And, you know, it was a book that was recommended to us by the librarian at the New York Public Library, who we have a nice little partnership with. And you know, we talked about this wonderful book, and just, man, the kids on the internet really responded to it and talked to us about it. By the same token, we read not long ago, or actually a couple years ago now at this point, Fault in Our Stars, the John Green internet and worldwide sensation.
Yes.
And we had really differing thoughts on it. And boy, were people mad at us. and that was fun, too.
It's nice to get, though, if you can get people talking about it, whether or not they agree, doesn't matter,
yeah.
They're talking about it. And
that's,
I think that's the whole bonus to it all, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing that, as a writer and as a teacher, makes me really happy, is just smart people talking about books and disagreeing about them is better than anything in the world. I mean, God, it's better than turning on the news and listening to politics. Smart people talking about empathy, basically, you know, that's gold right there for me. And it's just a lot of fun. You know, we do it once or twice a month. The episodes are about an hour long. There's a back catalog of 100 of them on iTunes right now. And people binge on them, and then they see me somewhere in public and say something to me that I think is some archaic fact from my personal life, and apparently have revealed it on the podcast, and I think, who is this person? How do they know this?
Good for you. Good for you.
And then invariably, I'll say to my wife, oh my God, someone strange came up to me and said something that about our personal lives. I don't know where they found this information. And she said, well, maybe it's,
just kind of look at you?
Yeah, maybe it's from the podcast that 100,000 people download once a month. I was like, right.
There you
yes,
go.
That.
That's probably it, that, right?
That's probably it.
So it seems to me that you have a lot of different creative sides to you, and so you're kind of feeding all of those sides because you're also a teacher, and because you started an MFA program, I've not done anything like that. I do different things, but I'm impressed by that, and probably almost as much as more than burnout has really done. All joking aside, I think that's an amazing thing that you did. How often do you teach, and do you enjoy that just as much?
Oh, I love to teach. The program that I direct, it's a low residency MFA program, which means the students work online and then they're in person for 10 days twice a year. And in fact, the spring residency concluded on Sunday, so I just got done teaching 10 straight days of workshops and seminars. And as a director of the program, I still teach 4 or 5 or 6 students every quarter. So I teach every single quarter, and it's fantastic. You know, right now, today, in fact, right this moment, or in 10 minutes, one of my recent graduates, an excellent writer named Natasha Dayon, is having her book launch in L.A. for her book Grace, which has received starred reviews from every publication in America, and is going to be a big bestseller.
How wonderful.
And I just think, there's not a better thing that I do as a person than help people achieve the things that they want to achieve. I don't have kids, but I have 8,000 MFA students. Well, it seems that way. I have 100 of them, and their success just makes me, it makes me glow. It's the best thing. And I love teaching creative writing. I had wonderful creative writing professors when I was coming up. I was given a hand by a lot of people when I was starting out. And it's something that I try to do for every single person that comes through this program that I started. And that's, it's from the teaching, of course, but it's also that every single student that I work with gets their manuscript read by agents and editors, or if they're screenwriters, by producers. And it's just the dictum that I live by, which is that writing is a business, and we should be able to help each other succeed in business.
You pay it forward, don't you? You got to pay it forward.
Yeah.
Well,
Todd,
probably is your legacy, then, it seems. It's wonderful that you've sold books. You're going to be on the New York Times tomorrow, bestseller list. You're like my hero because you wrote for Burn Notice. But in the long run... But in the long run, your legacy will be about what you've paid forward. So congratulations on that. I have so enjoyed talking to you. Would you do something for me?
I would love to.
Will you come back again? Come back.
I will come back anytime.
And come back and and invite one of your author friends, and you sit behind my microphone and let me listen to you. How about that?
Perfect. It's a deal. Done.
Take your student who just wrote Grace, and if you want, interview her or get Brad on or get whoever you want, and come sit behind the microphone and let me listen to you give a master class on podcasts too. I've only been doing this 4 years, so I'm sure I could learn. You know, I learn something new every day from all my guests. So I'd love to have you come back.
I'm happy to come back anytime. Can I take a nap first?
And yes, you may. Absolutely. You've got a couple books
right.
to write. You've got to go and, you know, celebrate and call up your brother and say, yana, 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 guess he's on the bestseller list, right?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Todd Goldberg, go get his new book that he just wrote and is now released with Brad Meltzer. It's called The House of Secrets. If you want a copy, I'm going to give away a hard copy. Find me on Facebook. You know where I am, for Pam Stack. And first one to message me about this conversation that Todd and I have had, I'm going to mail you the book. Todd, have a good evening. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks so much, Pam. It was my pleasure. I had a great time.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
And that's it for tonight. The next time you talk to me will be most likely, I don't know, let's see, maybe on Wednesday. Yeah, hey, Warren Moore and his daughter, Emily, are writers, and they're going to come and talk to us because we're celebrating Dad's Mom Month. Have a great evening. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.